Mrs. Keller, Rabbi Silver, and friends. Words cannot express my pleasure in being here as a part of this lecture series in your great temple. I have for so many years followed the career of your distinguished rabbi. As I was telling him this noon, I was on a ship across the Atlantic one year when at the table where we were sitting, there was a businessman from Texas who had the number 82 visa to Israel. And he told me that Rabbi Silver had the number 1 visa, which fact I verified at the luncheon today. It's rather a coincidence tonight that Rabbi Daniel Silver is in my city of St. Louis, speaking at Temple Sher Emeth of Rabbi Nodel's temple. I believe Rabbi Nodel used to be on the staff of this temple. It seems to me it would have been very much cheaper if Rabbi Silver had been here tonight and I'd stayed in St. Louis. I don't know which of us got the better break in the weather. I'm not certain what the answer is on that. Well, I have set Rabbi Silver the example of retiring. I retired on the 18th of November, so I am now the pastor emeritus of the Del Mar Baptist Church in St. Louis, which reminds me of a statement that Dr. Ralph Sockman made last summer at a program that we shared together. He has recently become the pastor emeritus of Christ Church Methodist in New York. And on this program, he referred to the fact that the former chaplain of the Senate, Peter Marshall, after his death, had been written up in a biography by his wife, Mrs. Marshall, the book being entitled A Man Called Peter. Some of you may have read it. Well, referring to this book by Catherine Marshall concerning her husband, A Man Called Peter, Dr. Sockman said, my wife, inspired by this fine example, is thinking of writing my biography under the title, The Man Who Petered Out. Rabbi, I hope that our wives won't take that too seriously. I feel it a great privilege to have a part in this lecture series, speaking tonight on the subject of the contribution of Protestantism to our American life. I want to congratulate you on the fact that you are having a series of this kind and the contributions of our various religious faiths to our American culture and democracy. These are difficult days in which we are living, well described by the man who said that it was a generation of guided missiles and misguided men. The nuclear age is an unclear age. All you need to do is to shift 2 letters in the word unclear and you have the nuclear age. And we need to consult the spiritual heritage that is ours respectively, to stand by the river of the years, to sense the flow and the rhythm of history, and to speak to the greatness of our time. For even though it is possibly a time of guided missiles and misguided men, it is nevertheless a great time, a significant era in the history of mankind, and we do well, all of us, to look to the story of our various religious faiths. Now, I think that we need to be delivered from simply appraising in some flattering way the respective faith to which we belong. Sometimes there is a religious boastfulness that is something akin to the type of patriotic 4th of July oratory that we have nationally. I think you've probably heard of the sophomore in a sophomore oratorical contest on a certain college campus who in the contest spoke on the subject of patriotism. He got his facts a little bit mixed, but he came up to this eloquent peroration. He said, and so, my fellow citizens, let us never forget that great day in the 4th of July, 1492, when the Pilgrim Fathers stepped forth on Plymouth Rock and there drew up the Declaration of Independence, which struck from the shackles of the black man the shackles of slavery and created this a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. There is a good deal of patriotic oratory like that and some religious oratory like that too. And I think we want to try to deal with these things objectively. Before I go further into the question of what Protestantism may have contributed to our American life, may I acknowledge the indebtedness that we all as Christians owe to Judaism in this connection. We can never forget what we owe to the children of Israel for our monotheistic faith. The great words, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one," is a majestic utterance that rings with equal impressiveness from the continental divides of America and across the Grand Canyon as those words did from Mount Sinai long ago. And when I think of the devotion of the Jewish people to the prophetic utterances of the Old Testament and what we owe in our ethical idealism and our loyalty to all that is highest and best to Judaism, I feel very humble indeed to speak tonight on the subject of the contribution of Protestantism. I feel the more so ever since 1956, when I spent about a month in Israel, living for a time on some of the cooperative farms, the kibbutzim, and visiting Jerusalem. I particularly remember a Sabbath evening in Jerusalem when we visited many of the ancient Orthodox synagogues of that city. And there we observed these great silver-bearded rabbis from Spain, from Persia, from Eastern Europe, and attended some of the services. There were two that I particularly remember. One was the Yemenite service. What a marvelous group of people, those refugees from Yemen, great, brawny, shouldered, sun-tanned people of the desert who had come to Jerusalem by plane and had thought of that as being the fulfillment of the prophecy that they would come to the city of Zion on wings. I shall never forget that synagogue service where these men who had been faithful to their faith in a very strange way were instructing their sons and their grandsons in the faith of the Yemenite Jews. They had been compelled by their Yemenite oppressors to conceal their faith, their worship, and so they had, as camel drivers, had disguised the songs of Israel and the great Psalms in terms of the camel driver's songs. And here in the synagogue that evening, as they sang these songs of Israel in the music of the camel drivers, with their sons and their grandsons, little boys sitting beside them and swaying with the movement of the camels as they sang, it was something that I shall never forget for its vividness. I suppose never in any other generation will there be an opportunity to sense the deep religious feeling that was in the lives of these men and women who had come from a period of oppression. I've had the same feeling in the Polish synagogue, where there were those alternating moods of the synagogue service. On the one hand, the tragedy as they prayed with protests against God, literally shaking their fists in the faces of God and crying out, "How long, O Lord, how long?" And then as they turned to the door of the synagogue to welcome the bride of the Sabbath, breaking out into laughter and shouting and singing, as they did also at the tomb of Israel, where one day I stood in the midst of 100 refugees from all parts of the world, with little children up on their shoulders, as they played music and sang in the presence of the tomb of David. I joined with them. They invited me to sing and to dance with them. And I heartily joined with them because I felt what a tremendous thing it was that the children of Israel, through these hundreds of years, had maintained their fidelity to the God of their fathers, what a survival value was there. And it must be a challenge to all of you in this day to keep that faith alive. Now, to come to the contribution of Protestantism, I did want to say this, because we are the spiritual heirs of Israel. I would have to go back a little bit, possibly, into the history of Protestantism to interpret what I believe is the contribution of Protestantism. There are three major divisions of our Christian faith. As you know, the Eastern Orthodox faith, the Roman Catholic faith, and our Protestant faith, with many other varying groups in addition, but those would probably be considered the outstanding ones. Now, in the beginning, of course, of Christendom, there was neither Catholicism, nor Protestantism, nor Eastern Orthodoxy. In the New Testament church, it was simply a little democratic group of believers, a stirring of the spirit within Judaism. These disciples gathered around the teaching and the person of Jesus of Nazareth, whom they looked to as the Savior from their sins and as the Lord of life, as indeed all of us as Christians still do. And then it continued to grow and expand through the Roman Empire until the early part of the 4th century, when in the reign of Emperor Constantine, Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And I suppose that we all would be agreed that that was probably one of the greatest tragedies that ever happened to the Christian faith, because when it became the official religion of the Roman state, then it became politically motivated, it became military-minded and persecution-minded, and instead of depending upon the voluntary person-to-person witness of the faith, it became coercive and tribal, so that from there on it became a state church. Then in the year 1054 AD, there came the first great cleavage in Christianity, when the Eastern Church broke with the Western Church, one with its capital at Constantinople, now Istanbul, under the patriarchate of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and then the other, the Roman Catholic Church, with its capital at Rome, under the authority of the Roman Catholic Papacy. Now, this continued until the early part of the 16th century, when under Martin Luther, the Protestant movement began. Martin Luther was not originally planning to leave the Catholic Church. He was a priest of the Catholic Church, and his intention was, in the beginning, simply that there should be a reform of Catholicism from within the church. But as he pressed the issue on these moral and spiritual matters that needed to be changed in the Catholic Church, the gap between him and the church became wider and wider, until he was excommunicated from the church, and the Protestant Reformation was then on in its full strength. Now, that was, in the beginning, Lutheranism, which continues in the great Lutheran church today. Little by little, there were other denominational groupings, the Episcopal Church or Anglican Church, Presbyterianism, Methodism, and other groups, the Baptists and the like. Now, I could incidentally go into a great many areas where I feel there was a contribution here in America, great revival movements which really brought religion to the frontiers of America in the pioneer days. All of these different Protestant denominations carried on missions to the frontier, built churches and schools. I suppose one of the greatest contributions was the building of schools. Before there was any public school system, great colleges like Harvard and Yale and Princeton, Colgate, Chicago, practically all of our major universities were started in the beginning as Protestant colleges, many of them like Harvard, for the purpose of educating the ministry. A great contribution also in the translation of the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, into more than 1,100 different dialects and languages which were distributed to all nations of the world. My own son, our youngest son, who is a doctor, is a medical missionary up in Burma, way up in some remote hill tribe areas, 45 miles from the Chinese border. 20 miles away from him, his nearest American neighbors are a young couple from Denver who are doing a marvelous job in the translation of the Bible into the Lahu and the Shan languages. This process has gone on in this country and in other countries, and I believe has been a part of what has been so well called the revolution of rising expectations. Because wherever the scriptures have gone, Old Testament and New Testament alike, there has been a new spirit of liberty and freedom kindled. Now in 1616 to 1611, there was another group within Protestantism that arose in England and in Holland. They were the group to which I myself belong, the Baptists, and I pause at this point to call attention to their particular contribution, because I think it is the most closely related to our American philosophy of government. Under the leadership of two men by the name of Thomas Helwys and John Smyth, in Spitalfield, England, and in Amsterdam in Holland, this group arose, which departed from the Protestant Reformation as it had been under Martin Luther, in two respects. First of all, they insisted upon, I have to mention one doctrine at this point because it's so closely related to religious liberty. The Baptists rejected the common practice both of Catholicism and of Eastern Orthodoxy and of Protestantism. They rejected what we call infant baptism. Most churches in Christendom baptize their babies soon after birth and dedicate them to the religion of their fathers. The Baptists, as they read their New Testament, contended that this had not been the practice of the early church, that there had been the baptism of believers only, and that people had to grow up to the age of choice so that of their own free will they could determine what their religion would be. And the Baptists insisted that not even the parents, not even the father or the mother, could decide for the child what its ultimate religion would be, that freedom must begin in the cradle. Now, this had significant results, as I shall show you in just a few moments, in the governmental philosophy of America. These people were the precursors of the Pilgrim Fathers. When they came over to this country, of course, in this country, the various Protestant groups carried on the second thing that Martin Luther had still permitted in his setup in Lutheranism, the relationship of church and state. Martin Luther had retained infant baptism. He had retained a state church. And the Baptists revolted against both of these concepts as being out of harmony with the New Testament scriptures. The denominations, whether Catholic or Protestant, that came to this country continued the state church idea. The Congregationalists were the state churches of New England. The Dutch Reformed Church was the state church of New York. The Episcopal Church was the state church of Virginia, and so on. Well, then there came a day when one of these Congregationalist ministers, Roger Williams, who was a minister of the Congregational Church in Massachusetts, began to preach the doctrine that the Baptists had been proclaiming. He, too, declared that he could no longer believe in infant baptism. And so he began to preach this doctrine of freedom in the cradle. And as he learned that he was about to be subject to deportation to England, he fled from Massachusetts to Providence, Rhode Island. And there he established the first government in the history of the Western world where a person could be a citizen with the privileges of the franchise regardless of his religion, whether he was Protestant or Catholic or Jewish or Mohammedan or Buddhist or even a pagan or an infidel. It's interesting that when we celebrated in 1938 the tercentenary of Roger Williams, because it was in 1638 that he began his work in Providence and established the colony of Rhode Island, I was then a pastor in St. Paul, and I remember that Rabbi Margolis, whom maybe you may remember, Rabbi Silver, invited me on that anniversary occasion to speak over the radio program of his temple in St. Paul, and that same evening to speak to the youth forum on the subject of the life and work of Roger Williams. Well, I said, how does it happen that you are interested in our anniversary? Well, he said, all over the country, the Jewish people are celebrating your anniversary because it was in Providence, Rhode Island, that Roger Williams established a government where for the first time in the New World, as the people of Israel, we could have the privilege of the franchise and of citizenship regardless of our religion. Now, in Maryland, Lord Baltimore had established a colony that approached this in a measure. There was certain religious liberty in Maryland also, but it was limited to Christians, Catholics and Protestants. I'm not sure whether those privileges were extended to Jews or not, but in general, those outside of the Christian faith were excluded, so that it was in Providence that really we have the first example of actual religious liberty. And it is interesting that on that tercentenary, one of my friends in Buffalo, New York, Dr. Frederick Reynolds, preaching a very eloquent sermon about Roger Williams, came up to a climax which wasn't quite correct either. He said, "And so, my fellow citizens, let us never forget our great pioneer Baptist, Will Rogers." Well, that pretty near broke up the meeting. There was and those two do get mixed up. Dr. Taylor, you remember Al Rapp, pastor of the Plymouth Congregational Church in Syracuse, New York, when we were there. He told me that one time that only about 40 or 50 years ago had there been removed from the statute books of Massachusetts the law which warned the people of Massachusetts against undesirable characters from Rhode Island, particularly Baptists. So we had a little battle on our hands at that time. Now, to indicate that this is not just a little bit of Baptist propaganda, I wouldn't want it to be that. It has to be interpreted. All of our Protestant bodies, as well as your Jewish fellowship, would support 100% the idea of the separation of church and state and religious liberty. I'm simply speaking of the pioneer phases of it. And to indicate the part that we did play in this movement, if you should go down to Richmond, Virginia, to Orange County, and just go outside of town a little ways, you would see there a monument in the form of a great, rough, unhewn boulder. And on that monument, there is a tablet indicating that it was at that spot that James Madison, later President of the United States, entered into a political agreement with one of our Baptist pastors of the time, the Reverend John Leland, whereby John Leland, the Baptist minister, agreed to step out of the political race and give way to James Madison in the election of delegates to the convention, the Virginia Convention, that was to ratify the American Constitution. Madison knew that he could not win without Orange County because it was a solidly Baptist county. On the other hand, John Leland knew that James Madison was the more influential voice. So Leland withdrew from the race on the condition that James Madison would promise to support the principle of the separation of church and state. And it was in large measure as a result of that political agreement, with other factors, of course, entering in, but largely as a result of that agreement, that we have in our Bill of Rights today the provision that guarantees that there shall be separation of church and state in our country. I owe a great deal in my own family to this religious liberty. My people broke with a state church in Europe, a Protestant state church, with the result that they were severely persecuted. About 100 years ago, my grandparents broke with a state church. My father, who came to this country with his father when he was 12 years of age, I can remember my father telling about how in the early Baptist meetings in Sweden, many of them held in their home, the mobs would gather and the police would come and break up the meeting and arrest the preacher. He spoke particularly of one incident in which the preacher was in the middle of his sermon when the mobs came and the police came, and they immediately darkened all of the lights and opened the door, and one woman with great presence of mind threw her shawl over the head and shoulders of the preacher, and as they went out of the door said in a voice loud enough so that all the crowd could hear, "Come now, Grandma, it's time that we should be going home." And so by that ruse he escaped. But my own Aunt Annie, my mother's oldest sister, who was then 18 years of age, had to be baptized in the river under a bridge at midnight to escape the stoning of the mob. And to illustrate, and I'm bringing this out because we have something to safeguard in America at this point, to illustrate the extremes to which a state church would go, and I don't need to speak to you about this, who have, some of you lived in the ghettos of Europe under the oppressive hands of state churches, both Protestant and Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic. To illustrate how far even a Protestant state church would go, I think of an old man that was a member of my church in St. Paul, Peter Ryden, 85 years of age, who wrote a history of the Swedish Baptists in this country. He sat in my study one day and told me that when he was born, his father and mother, who had recently become Baptists at the time, did not baptize him because they had accepted this doctrine of the baptism of believers only. About 2 or 3 weeks after the birth of the baby, the priest of the village, or the minister, came to their home with what would correspond to the sheriff in our country and asked why they hadn't brought the baby down to the church to be baptized. And they said, "Well, we have become Baptists. We have accepted the doctrine of the baptism of believers only, and so we want the baby to grow up to make his own choice." Well, the baby must be baptized, and they took the priest and the policeman took the baby out of the cradle, took it down to the church, and baptized it without the parents' consent. 2 or 3 weeks later, they got a bill for the baptismal fee, which the parents of the baby disregarded. Again, the minister came and the sheriff and said, "Why have you not paid your baptismal fee?" And they said, "We do not intend to pay it. The baby was baptized without our consent." "You must pay the fee," they said. "Well," said Mr. Ryden's father, "the only way that you can collect that fee then is by force, the way you took the baby." And they actually went out into the barn and led away their only cow as the payment of that baptismal fee. So that in these movements, there was not simply a religious motivation, there was also an economic motivation, there was a revolt against the oppressive hand of an ecclesiastical tyranny that was joined to a state tyranny. Now, the situation, fortunately, is very different in that country now, and yet I'd like to go on to indicate how much we need to be on guard, whatever our religious faith may be, that this precious and priceless principle of the separation of church and state and religious liberty might survive. Because it has not been established as a world principle as yet, even though it is in the Charter of the United Nations. A few years ago, I was in Franco, Spain, for example, 1958, where a number of our Protestant churches had been closed and sealed by the Franco government. I'll never forget one day when I stepped into a little church where the doors had great strips of scotch tape, some type of sealing material, across the doors. That church had been closed since 1954 for the simple reason that there had been some teaching of their faith in the community in a very quiet way. And the ironical thing about it was that over those sealed doors, you could still read in gold and purple the words from the 100th Psalm, "Enter his gates with thanksgiving." Shortly before I was there, the pastor and one of his deacons had been arrested simply by reason of the fact that they had gone into that little sanctuary and kneeled at the altar to pray. I spent nearly an hour with our American ambassador, petitioning him to move this situation and try to do something about it. And I remember that evening we met with the Protestant Council on Religious Freedom. But the ambassador said that he had tried in vain to accomplish anything, and the situation still prevails. Now, this principle is imperiled even in America. I think we should watch very closely the attempt that is now being made in certain circles to provide tax support for church-related or parochial schools. Now, this is not to say that there should not be religious schools or parochial schools. I'm speaking simply of tax-supported schools. We Baptists and other Protestant groups have some parochial schools. The Missouri Synod Lutherans in Missouri have some of the finest parochial schools to be found anywhere. But they never ask for a dollar from the state. They pay the bill, as any church or religious body ought to do if it is going to have a church-related or parochial school. But we know the drive that is being made today for state support of parochial schools, and there is the whole question of religious liberty in many other areas, the adoption of children, the question of birth control information, and many other areas where this question comes in. Now, there's a plausible argument that we should appropriate tax funds pro rata, that is, according to the number of each group. That sounds very reasonable, that Catholics should have so much in proportion to their population for their schools, that Protestants should have so much for theirs, or Jews so much for theirs. But have we ever stopped to think what that would do to our whole American system of public school education? It would split it into thousands of splinters. Because in our pluralistic society, where we have, even within Protestantism, some 250 different groups and sects, although 90% of them are within 7 or 8 major denominations, if we should start that proposition, we would then have a constant battle in state and federal governments for appropriations, not only to these major groups that I have mentioned, but to the Mormons, to the Jehovah's Witnesses, and as the Christian Century pointed out a few weeks ago, possibly even to the black Muslims. Any religious group would then have a right to come to the government and say, we represent this proportion of the population, we are entitled to this proportion of the tax budget for our schools. As I see it from this place where I stand tonight, that would mean the end of the public school system of America as we know it, a system which I believe is one of the most priceless possessions that we have in our great republic. It would mean, moreover, that we would have in America what they have in Europe, competing clerical parties, each one working for its particular favorite project. When you hear the name of a political party like the Christian Democrats, for example, you know that that's a clerical party. It's a state church proposition. I remember interesting comment on this matter that was made in connection with a banquet that was held in Detroit some time ago, where there was a representative of the West German government to be the speaker. The Toastmaster was a very ardent Republican. Now, this has no local applications whatsoever. But the chairman was a very ardent Republican, and while they were waiting for the program to start, he said to the visitor from West Germany, what political party do you belong to in West Germany? The Christian Democrat, said the guest. The Republican got purple in the face. He said, in this country, you can't be both. And I can well imagine that that might be true. Now, in conclusion, I would like to say that if we are going to safeguard this heritage, which is precious to Jews and to Christians, and may I just insert here one thing that I omitted. It is interesting, in Providence, Rhode Island, that the little plot of ground where Roger Williams had his first meeting with a dozen or so followers back in 1638 was purchased by a Jewish citizen of Providence and presented to the city as a little public park in appreciation of what Roger Williams had meant to the Jewish faith and to religious liberty. And when our National Baptist Memorial Church was erected in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, one of the largest contributors to the building fund was an outstanding Jewish citizen who likewise gave a fine gift in recognition of the values of religious liberty. As I say, this is something that is shared by all Protestants. It's shared and supported by Jewish friends and religious groups generally, with one or two outstanding exceptions. Now, I think that if we're going to resolve these issues, we must do so in a new climate. I have the feeling that we're in a sort of a cold war at the present time between the groups that are working hard for tax support of public schools and those who, like some of the rest of us, are opposed to it. We're in a deadlock, and I think we've got to find some solution that will represent the results of what has been called cooperative conflict. It's a very real danger that in this battle between Catholics and Protestants and Jews over the public school issue, that we could end up as a purely secular country, devoted to a religion called the American way of life, but not to the religion of Israel or of Christianity, either one. I saw a statement by an outstanding citizen of St. Louis the other day who said, it doesn't make any difference what we believe as long as we respect each other's beliefs. I don't go along with that philosophy for a moment. It makes a great deal of difference what we believe. And if we take this superficially tolerant attitude that it doesn't make any difference what we believe as long as we respect each other's beliefs, that opens the way to an invasion of totalitarian secular philosophies that could reduce the United States to the fate of Germany during the Nazi regime or to the communist countries today. You know, Hitler said on one occasion, in explanation of his rise to power, he said, I saw empty thrones all over Europe, and I just went in and sat down on one of them. And if we have empty religious thrones with no faith in God, no devotion to the great purposes of the prophets of the Old Testament or to the Christ and the apostles of the New Testament, I say that we open the way to an invasion of secular tyranny that could crush out all of the liberty that we ever possessed. I believe that it is important that we should have a great development of what we call today the ecumenical movement. I've had the privilege for 3 years, from 57 to 1960, as your chairman said, of serving as the president of the National Council of Churches. I've served on the Central Committee of the World Council of Churches, and I feel a sense of mission about this, because I believe that only insofar as all of our religious groups enter into communication with each other, into conversation and dialogue, and a new religious climate is created of understanding and goodwill, that we can settle these critical issues, which today, as I say, are in a state of cold war. I've been greatly heartened by the Vatican Council in Rome. I was greatly heartened by the New Delhi Assembly of the World Council of Churches, our Protestant and Eastern Orthodox groupings. There at New Delhi were representatives of nearly 200 religious traditions, all the way from the extremely ritualistic ancient churches like the Greek Catholic Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, to the Quakers, the Salvation Army, and the Pentecostalists of South America, the most extremely different groups that you could have. And yet these more than 200 religious traditions representing 90 different countries and territories of the world came together and debated the most explosive issues of our time: communism, democracy, bomb tests, race relations, family life, everything that could have meant an explosion, and yet it was all debated in the most courteous spirit, a goodwill and understanding which ministered to the reconciling spirit that we so sorely need. And I believe that the same spirit is developing in Roman Catholicism in a measure under the leadership of Pope John. We had a dialogue with our Roman Catholic friends in St. Louis just a few weeks ago. Cardinal Ritter and four or five other priests of the Catholic Church had just returned from Rome the night before, and in the presence of about 200 of our Protestant clergy and Catholic priests, they brought a report which I would hardly have believed 10 years ago. They spoke about the necessity of a reappraisal of the Protestant Reformation to discover its basic values. They spoke of the necessity for a reappraisal by the Catholic Church of the Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent. They spoke about the necessity of appraising again the authority of the Scriptures as over against the priesthood, and even went so far as to say that there had to be a study made of a possible redistribution of the power now too highly centralized in Rome. It was amazing. And I believe this holds great promise for the future. And I suppose that it's not necessarily in these ecclesiastical pronouncements that the greatest progress is made, but in the informal connections that we have in this instance. I remember that after the New Delhi Assembly of the World Council of Churches, Mrs. Dahlberg and I went up to Nepal for a few days at the foot of the Himalayas. And what was my delight up there to meet the only Roman Catholic official representative of the United States among five representatives for the whole world, Father Duff, one of our fellow St. Louisans. Well, we were delighted to see each other, of course, no matter what religious faith you belong to when you're 10,000 or 12,000 miles away from home. You're awfully glad to see each other as fellow Americans, and particularly fellow St. Louisans, regardless of weather. And so we were standing there in the ancient capital city of Butgaon, just outside of the present capital of Kathmandu. And as we were in conversation together and taking pictures, as Americans always do, of the temples and the sacred cattle and the picturesque costumes and the like, suddenly one of these sacred bulls came up and butted us vigorously from the rear, really dusted us off for fair. Took us completely by surprise. Fortunately, he had no sharp horns. He had broken horns, did us no damage, but we were considerably upset, dusted off our clothes. Well, it happened that the church editor, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, had asked me if I would write a little report while I was away of the New Delhi Assembly, particularly anything of human interest. Well, I thought that this might be a little of human interest, so I wrote about this incident, just put in a little paragraph. What was my dismay when I came home, clear across the top of the church page of the Saturday Evening Dispatch, this headline: Brahma Bull Butts Duff and Dahlberg. Well, I was a little bit disturbed. I wrote a letter right away to Father Duff, who's a very outstanding Roman Catholic. He's the editor of their Social Action Journal, and has written a fine book on the social outlook of the World Council of Churches. I said, "Dear Father Duff, I was a little bit disturbed by that sensational headline in the Post-Dispatch the other night. I hope it hasn't upset your ecclesiastical dignity too much." He wrote a delightful letter back, and he said, "On the contrary," he said, "my Jesuit brethren here have had a good laugh over it. They said I've been throwing the bull around here so long it was time that the bull tossed me." I reported this to some of my fellow pastors in St. Louis. One of them said, "Was that a papal bull?" Well, you can carry that as far as you like. I'm very much interested in a cooperative church life, and these increasing evidences of goodwill and understanding and fraternity, such as you're demonstrating in this series of lectures, I believe has in it great significance for the future of our country. And in all of this, let us be sure that we preserve that religious liberty, which to my mind is one of the basic things in our American philosophy. We need not only a book on advice and consent, we need a book also on advise and dissent. There's room for variety in unity and room for unity in variety. And how necessary it is that with this religious liberty, we should have solidarity, cooperation of all like-minded men and women of goodwill who believe in God and the great commandments to love God with all our heart, soul, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. If we're going to win out over the forces of racism and militarism and materialism and gangsterism and all of the things that threaten our American life, we must close the ranks and present a united force of righteousness. You maybe have read that book, The Last Day. There's a verse in the New Testament which quotes Jesus as saying, "Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest he deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. For I say unto thee that thou shalt not come out thence till thou hast paid the last farthing." The urgency of agreement today is very great in terms of this book, The Last Day, which I think of in connection with Jesus' words, The Last Farthing. In this novel, you may remember that there was a young couple going up to New England to their cottage on the beach for their summer vacation. And on the way, they were concerned as to whether there had been anybody that had built a house on the vacant lot next to them that might shut off partially the view of the ocean. When they came up there, sure enough, they found that in the intervening time, there had been a house built there so that their view was not as good as before. And they were terribly aggravated about that. That night, about 10 o'clock, as they stood looking out at the ocean, there was a tremendous flash that illuminated all the heavens. And the young husband who had been in the Air Force recognized it immediately for what it was, the explosion of an atomic bomb. And he began to count the seconds to determine the distance away from them. It was 150 miles away. They gathered together the 10 or 12 people who had been startled by the shock that came with the sound of the explosion that shattered the doors, hurled the people to the floor. They began to gather together all of their canned goods, fresh water supplies, everything that they could think of that they would need. But in spite of it, one by one through the following week, they died. Until at last, there were only three left. The young wife and two others, one of them a doctor. They distributed what few aspirin pills and sleeping pills they had left. The two men died. This young wife was left. And she thought that she would go out and spend her last moments in a little hollow among the sand dunes, where no wind ever came, and where she used to listen to the lovely song of a little brown bird that used to sing there. As she left their shelter and went out to this sand dune, she saw on the docks the dead seagulls, she saw the dead cattle in the meadows. Everything was so silent and still. Finally, she came into the hollow among the sand dunes, and there she lay down to die. Her eyes paining her lips suppurating, her face flushed, her bones in anguish, she heard once again the little brown bird singing, its notes coming down like liquid raindrops from the sky. And it was as if the little bird were singing, "Isn't the world beautiful? Isn't God good?" And there the book ended, with just that little note of hope that possibly some life might survive. We are living in a time of guided missiles and misguided men. May God guide us into that fellowship and understanding that shall save our world from an imminent destruction. God bless us all.